Very good. So, welcome to this morning's Dhamma talk. And I promise to continue on with talking about the meditation, especially the breath meditation, the Anapanasati. And just got to the very first part of it about establishing mindfulness, Paramukkhana, as a priority. And that establishing mindfulness as a priority is very important, simply because in all those years I've been teaching meditation, I meet many people who try to do breath meditation and give up because they don't get much success. And they sort of ask, well, I tried it, I tried to watch my breath, but it didn't work. And sometimes instead of saying, well, it didn't work for me, you'd look at the instructions and were you following them, you know, appropriately. I know it's usually the case that somebody, say, buys a new microwave and they plug it in and it goes bang, and only afterwards do they read the instruction manual. It's much better to read the instruction manual first before using something. So the instruction manual for watching the breathing is, first of all, just prepare your body and mind so it's ready to be able to relax and be able to be aware of the breath. So when you're actually looking at the body, you can see, is my body just comfortable enough to be able to watch the breath? Even sometimes people, before they do go to play some sports, they do warm-up, do exercises first of all, so that they're ready to do the game, whichever they're playing. And that preliminary is important. Even having done a bit of building, a lot of time and effort goes into the foundations, making sure the soil is okay, making sure they get the foundations of that building very, very strong. Because otherwise, we'll end up with the Leaning Tower of Pisa. Because they cut down on the money for the foundations. And that's not a very good idea, because the foundations, once you get the foundations in, it's very difficult to dig them out and just replace them. So this building here is very solidly built. So I don't have to worry about those foundations for years and years and years and years and years. So it's the same with the meditation. If you get those foundations correct, then you find you've got the mindfulness coming up and it is stable enough. Present moment, silence. And the silence isn't that hard to develop. If you are in the present moment, you're not really too worried about what went on in the past or the future, that you'll leave that until, you know, when you go home, then at least you have the present moment awareness. But the silence is very difficult for people of today's age to actually develop. And I wondered sometimes why it is that we think so much. And I think it's our school teachers' faults. Any school teachers here? Come on, you can admit it. You don't need to be embarrassed. Because I sort of remember when I was a kid, the teacher would look at you and say, what do you think of that? I said, nothing. I was a budding monk meditator, and they put off my enlightenment for many, many years by saying, stupid, you've got to think about something. If you don't think about something, you're dumb. So I was forced to think by my school teachers. But wouldn't it be wonderful just instead of thinking, just feeling? Now, one exercise you might try today to calm the mind down, to have some silence and increase your mindfulness, your power of mindfulness, is actually when you go for a walk, don't talk to anybody. Listen to the birds. Listen to the sound of the leaves on the trees rustling in the wind. if the rain falls, listen to it. The beautiful sounds of nature. Because the sounds of nature are subtle, soft, and very beautiful. And you may notice that when you're listening to the sound of the birds, you're not thinking. You're silent. So, if it's not listening to things is probably the best way of overcoming the thinking mind. Feeling sensations in your feet, say, as you're walking in this compound here. I must admit that when I walk here, when I go over to Bodhinyana Monastery, yeah, I do wear my shoes. But here I don't like wearing the shoes because I like to feel the floor, the concrete, the carpet, whatever it is underneath my feet, to actually feel them. And over here in Australia, especially here, it's so clean. So you can walk all day with your shoes and you don't get dirty. I remember in Bangkok, you just walk about 10 meters and your feet are black. But over here, it's a very clean environment. So you can take off your shoes and your socks and just walk barefoot and actually feel the sensations in your feet. It is true that sometimes that people say, oh, you monks, you should live in the real world. And I bristle at saying that we should live in the real world, because when I look at my life and the life out there, and how many of you dye your hair? I don't dye my hair. How many of you have cosmetic surgery? Not me. How many of you wear makeup? Not me. Although I must admit, I did wear makeup once as a monk. One of the most embarrassing times of my life. Because I made the big mistake of actually bringing Ajahn Bhumali with me to an interview in a TV station. And in the TV station, because it's in the studio, the lights are very strong. And in those days, if you didn't put something on your face, it would actually be glisten. It would just reflect all the lights. And so I said, do I have to? He said, yes. And so as they were putting whatever they put on there, Ajahn Bhumali, my friend, was making faces at me. Thank you for my friends. But anyway, that was just for the TV thing. But apparently they don't need it because I think the cameras don't need so much light. But air conditioning, is that real or fake? Heating is so much, which we have in our life, for our comfort, it's fair enough. But are you really in the real world? Sometimes, if it is raining, remember as a kid, going out getting wet, getting all your hair soaked. If you want to get your hair soaked and understand what it feels like, you can always come over to Bodhinyana Monastery and I'll give a blessing with some holy water. Which Helen got the other day. But it's just like getting real. And I do notice, we do this, speaking of the holy water stuff, but the children, when the children get sprinkled with holy water, they squeal in delight. And it's worth it to see their faces because it's tactile. At last it's something they can understand when they come to a Buddhist monastery. They feel it, and it's just nice and exhilarating. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, you love, you know, when you get the right kids and speak with holy water, they squeal and laugh. And but anyway, that this is actually learning how to feel. Now, physical feelings, and not be afraid of them. And that actually stops you thinking. You start to live in a world, a real world, rather than a world of thoughts and should-be's and can't-do's and and all that stuff, because once you start a thought, that thought can go so many different ways and get into all sorts of negativity, all sorts of desires, because it's one thought leads to another. But when you stop the thoughts, because you're feeling, experiencing the cold, the wind, that could often stop you thinking. So those are some more ways where you can see if you can find moments in life when there's hardly a thought going on in your mind, or even no thoughts at all. As a young man, I went through many stages of my likes in music. But eventually, before I became a monk, the music I liked was classical music. And you could sit there for an hour listening to music. And I wondered why it was that it was so delightful. And one of the reasons was, is because as that music was progressing, I never thought. No thought came in my head when I was listening to, it's weird, but the choral music I like, no, it was not choral, Monteverdi. I don't know why I really like that music. And I listened to it for such a long time, and only later I realized there was not a thought going on in my head as I was listening, because every note, every chord just took up my full attention. And if you went to a classical music concert, everyone had to be quiet while they were sitting in the theatre or in the concert hall. Can you imagine? In the middle of the recital, then someone said, "Hey, that was good, wasn't it?" And the people say, "Shh, be quiet." Because it meant you weren't attending to the flow of the music. And that's one of the reasons why I developed a little simile. I haven't said it for a long while. And I put this, I think, in that Basic Method of Meditation booklet. Sometimes it's like you're the host at a party or some event, and you're standing at the door greeting your guests as they walk in. And all you can do is just to greet them and then go to the next guest, because there's so many guests coming one after the other. If you linger with a favourite guest and start talking to them, you miss so many other guests who are coming in behind. And in that simile, of course, the guests are all the different sensations, experiences which flow into your mind in every moment. If you linger in one moment, you will miss so many of the moments coming behind. So sometimes using that metaphor of just greeting every moment which comes into my conscious awareness, and then immediately going on to the next moment, and the next moment, and the next moment, and being attentive to the flow of experience, but without trying to capture any moment. When you try and capture moments, you're not mindful anymore. "Wow, that was a really interesting experience. Then you've missed what comes afterwards. I had my lesson when, just something a year before I became a monk, I thought, I'm a Buddhist, I should go on pilgrimage to India. So I went to pilgrimage to India the year before, 1 year before I became a monk. I didn't do my research. Yeah, I wanted to see the holy places, but do you know, I could never find where Kusinara was. I went to in Delhi, the tourist office there. Where's Kusinara? We don't know. So I didn't do much. It wasn't. And when I went to Bodh Gaya, that was really cool. What was that, 1973 or something? That was cool because there's hardly anyone there. You know, it's not like today when there's throngs of people. You could just walk there and just walk here, walk there, and you wouldn't even see many people. It was almost like abandoned. I always remember that. It was just so wonderful. But anyway, one of the other things I always wanted to do was to see the Himalaya Mountains. the most majestic stretch of peaks you could. You know, I saw them on the photo, on the pictures, I saw them in the magazines. I wanted to see them for myself. So I went down there and had a little camera to take my photos of them. And that's a big mistake, cameras. Because after a few weeks there, I realized I hadn't done my research at all. It was monsoon season. And you couldn't see even one peak. It was just a mass of clouds on the northern horizon. So I just, after 2 or 3 weeks, gave up trying to see the Himalaya mountains. But then I was in Kathmandu, and there was a couple of other people saying, oh, you know, there's this wonderful way you can just at least go to the Tibetan border in the postal bus. And it's a bit illegal because you just have to pay the postal bus driver a little bribe and he'll take you in the back of the post bus. So it's a really nice little trip. So we went up there and we got sort of made lunchtime, and he was going to have his lunch for an hour, and you know, we had already eaten, myself and the two other people there. And there was a little hill. Let's climb up the top of the hill for some exercise. We climbed up the top of the hill. And as soon as we got to the top of that hill, the clouds parted. And you could see just the whole range of the Himalaya mountains. Wow, that was awesome. So what did I do? I turned around, ran down as fast as I could to the bottom of the hill, picked up my camera, ran back up, and I was much faster. It would take me forever these days. But ran back up as fast as I could. And when I got to the top, I just saw it just close. And the two other guests, these two Americans, they were saying, where did you go? That was fantastic. Dumb. But it taught me a great lesson. You can't capture nimittas or jhanas or enlightenment. You can't take a photograph of, here's nimitta, here's me, smile. These ones you experience and you let them go, and as soon as you try to capture them, they vanish. That was a lesson that taught me. Of course, I saw the Himalaya mountains later on in my life, but that was just so cool to be taught such a lesson. So it's the same with much in life. We don't need to think and plan. You may even say your life is an experience, is a series of unexpected events. Every time I plan for things, they always just, they change, they go wrong slightly. But when they go wrong and you adapt, that's where life becomes very interesting. Everything I've ever done in my life, I never planned. Not really. It just happens. Yeah, you have some plans, but you're always open and even looking forward to when plans go wrong. Because when they go wrong, that's where life becomes really interesting. When things you never expected to happen, happen. Even like, you know, being a monk. Sometimes I only planned to be a monk for a short time. I thought that I'd go off to Thailand, become a monk for 1 or 2 years, get enlightened, get that out of the way, and then go in my list of things to do, and then go back and get a job and get married and have a family and stuff, that sort of stuff. But you realise that it didn't actually quite work like that. So anyway, and many of the things in life are totally unexpected, and so you don't need to think about it. Just be open and let it happen. Sometimes that people think because they're scared, it's almost like their safety mechanism. And when they think, they try and figure out all the possible dangers and all of their plans in case this happens, in case that happens, in case something else happens. And you find what actually happens is something you never planned. But whenever you are able to change, to adapt, to see a different way of doing things, That is where life happens. Ability to be still and see a different solution. So anyway, this is where we learn how to neglect thinking and don't give it as much importance. I don't mean you'd be totally thoughtless. I saw this cartoon. Sometimes I cut out these cartoons, and many of those cartoons you actually can see on the notice board in the dining room. This is other one I saw the other day. I didn't cut out, and that was where these two monks and the abbot was giving an award to the junior monk for being the most thoughtless monk of the week. But being thoughtless is supposed to be a terrible thing. But this is a wonderful thing in a meditation, so please be thoughtless. Then we find that we can have a stronger mindfulness. What's happening is all the thoughts, the worries, the plans, especially the negativity, that sucks your energy. That drains you. Which means you get tired. You get negative, you get more depressed. And so your mindfulness has very little power to it. To have the sort of power to be able to watch the breath, you have to be reasonably still. So I meant reasonably silent in this moment and have some happiness, the next part of mindfulness, happiness. To me it was weird when I found that people were trying to be mindful with force and they weren't happy at all. They weren't joyful in their meditation. I couldn't understand how on earth they could last as a meditator for so long when there's no joy in it, no smile. Because it's something which I learnt as a meditator, that when you are silent, when you are in this moment, when you don't waste energy by thinking too much, you get a burst of power, of energy. It was that. Well, I think it was, you might call this the Avijñāna and Saṅkhāra part of the mind, but I call it instead the knower and the doer. And it was a very beautiful way of understanding how your mind works and how mindfulness works. That there are two parts to the human mind, the knower, that which receives information, just knows what's happening, can feel sensations, pleasant and unpleasant, which can know what I'm talking about. You can actually receive the information, hear the sounds. And then there's the doer, the reactor, the one which comments or just does something about what it feels or what it hears and plans things. That active part of your mind, which I call the doer. And the other one is the knower. And having made that discrimination, that distinction, knowing and doing, I also noticed that in deep meditation, or even in little meditation, I was doing very little. Hardly thinking, not moving, being tranquil, body of mind, kaya pasadi and citta pasadi, really tranquil. And I was just noticing what was happening, just receiving information without reacting. And I found that my energy started to grow and lift. I started to wake up, I started to become energized and started to become happy. And after a while you realize the connection of those two parts of the human mind, the doer and the knower. The doer takes the first share of all of your energy. And because many of us in our modern world have to do so much, our duties, responsibilities, the things we're called upon to do are so intense that we do so much that we get tired. And it's not just physical tiredness. It is that our mind just has little energy. And that's one of the major causes of what we call these days depression. People are just tired. If you are asked to do much, a lot, and you do get disappointed in life, things don't go your way, a lot of people, instead of just letting go, giving up, they try even harder. They really ramp up their energy, their will, their determination. When the going gets tough, the tough get going, and then they get angry, and then they get depressed when they can't continue going on any further. So, instead of keeping on forcing and using your energy of will and doing, that's what tires us all out. And here, hopefully, you're getting the message that instead of doing something, we are quiet. To quote Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh, don't just do something, sit there. Turning around that phrase of instead of doing something, sitting there. Counterintuitive, but very powerful. Learning how to do nothing. And it's not laziness. You know the difference between a lazy person and someone who knows how to be still by the effect it has on them. Lazy person gets dull. A lazy person doesn't generate energy. A lazy person just goes fantasizing or dreaming. They're not really doing nothing. But if you really know how to do nothing, your energies get recharged. You get more alert, more awake, and you can feel it. Before you were tired, now you're awake. Before you were a little bit dull-witted, now you're energized. Before it was just so hard to actually to listen to the beautiful sounds of the birds, now they're all around you, wonder why you missed them. Before you just couldn't even see the sunrise, now you can see it and it's beautiful and it's gorgeous and it gets even more gorgeous. Before you ate the food at breakfast and lunch and it was pretty good, but now the food is absolutely delicious because your awareness is getting stronger and stronger. Everything becomes more delicious, more beautiful. There's many stories about that. And one of those stories was, this was while I was still in Thailand at this time, doing walking meditation in the hall during the monsoon, it was raining. And it was just a concrete floor. And it was laid by the villagers. It wasn't even flat, it was very bumpy. But nevertheless, it served its purpose. And you're doing walking meditation, getting really calm, very aware. And in walking meditation, putting your attention to like a body length in front of you. Only just because you don't want to step on something or hit the wall in front of you, because you're thinking about all sorts of things instead of paying attention to your walking. And just looking at that floor until I had to stop. And I stopped because the floor, the concrete, there's so many different shades of grey in that concrete. And people said, be careful that word, because that apparently was a naughty book which was written some years ago. So the many shades of grey in the concrete floor. I'm a good monk. Sometimes you don't know what goes on in that world. But anyway, so all the different shades of grey, and just, it was like a, it had contours, it had, it was like a geological sample of just valleys and hills, and the more I looked at it, the more beautiful it started to appear. And I saw just in an ordinary lump of concrete, sort of something which was so amazingly beautiful. And I stared at it for about 15 or 20 minutes, just in awe of just a really ordinary lump of concrete. And that's what happens to you when your mindfulness starts to get strong. So many things in life, they just, it's like they're always there, but it's like you can see so much more. And it reminded me of a part of a poem by William Blake, who is a mystic. He was an amazing person. William Blake, he did many artistic works. He did that one of Isaac Newton, just drawing something, and it's on a rock, and a very brilliant painting. I remember that one. But he also was a poet, and he wrote, "To see a world in a grain of sand, see a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour." I thought that sounded really cool. I always remembered it. To see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wild flower. But what did he mean by that? And of course, when you're meditating and you get peaceful, you don't do very much, and your energy starts to go into knowing, into mindfulness, you really start to see that. You go outside, and then maybe that little the crushed gravel, which is used around the stupas as, you know, as I think the Japanese landscape artist who designed that, because his son was a monk with me for a while, and he said, that's a dry lake, they call it. Because, you know, it looks as if it's different than the grass. It's got the right colour, sort of bluish granite rocks. And he said, that's what it's like, a dry lake. And you look at just one, just take up one of those little shards of granite and you look at it and it's, wow, amazing what you can see in there. Just in a small grain of rock, you can see a whole world. It opens up to you. And then you go and see a blade of grass or a little flower poking up somewhere. And just look at it and allow it just to show itself to you. You see a whole world in there, a heaven in a wild flower. So what you're doing, you're opening up your mindfulness. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand. No boundaries, no limits. An eternity in an hour. Which is a usual time of my Dhamma talks. Which go on forever. But it doesn't mean that. It means that eternity, no time, no limits in any time. Oh, you know that when you're on a retreat. You're just here, just now. Does it really feel like... Actually, how many days have gone? 2 or 3 days have gone already? Does it feel like that? Maybe it's because I always come in here to teach meditation retreats so often that sometimes here we are again. It's like we've never left. And Claire, you always sit over there when I teach retreats. If you're allowed to sit here, then you sit over here. It seems to be the same as before. Here we go again. So, this is almost like timeless. You're breaking down these conceptions of yesterday and tomorrow and eternity. To break that down until there's no time at all. And imagine, just imagine, no time. Just this moment. So much stress will disappear. Just this moment. All those deeds, bad deeds, good deeds, which you've done in the past. They just don't exist. It's just this moment. And all future attaining jhanas, nimittas or whatever, all that just disappears. That's in the future somewhere. You're just here. Hold eternity in this moment. How free would that be? It's like those simile I was mentioning. They match. That when I go off on traveling anywhere, I don't go anywhere. I just sit on the aircraft. The aircraft, the jet plane, does all the moving. I just do the sitting. Change your perception around. And that means there is no time. In fact, I think it's... Is that clock still in there, that no clock? Or is someone taking it out? In the walk-in meditation hall. No, just in that room over there. Haven't you explored those rooms yet? They're the walk-in meditation rooms. Maybe I should say something about that one day. But anyway, there somebody once asked me, what time is it? And the answer is, it's the nowth minute past the nowth hour on the nowth day of the nowth month, 2000 and now. Isn't it? So what we're doing is we're learning how just to be here. And as you be here, the longer you stay here in this moment, the more beautiful it becomes. It's like even your bed in your room in the cottage. At first it's not comfortable, you're not used to it yet. After a couple of days it's your own little bed, and sometimes you feel like you want to take the pillow back home with you because it's nice and comfortable, and you snuggle into it. Just like this moment, at first it may be a bit weird, and sometimes you want to run away. But after a while you get so comfortable in this moment and realize this is your real home. Right now. Why do I want to go anywhere else? So it becomes enjoyable being in this moment. As you stop thinking, instead of you talking back to the world starts to teach you. And it becomes even more joyful and beautiful than you'd ever expected. Sometimes I wondered about that. The world is supposed to be suffering. It's supposed to have nibbida towards it. But then you see the most beautiful piece of concrete. Or just after your retreat, you bite into one single baked bean and it's incredible. Why? And what's that got to do with breath meditation? What it's got to do is everything. Because then once you establish your mindfulness, and it's nice and strong, you watch the breath. One breath is so gorgeous. So many different sensations from the beginning of a breath to the end of a breath. And once you're really aware, no two breaths are ever the same. It becomes incredibly fascinating. It is a good time just to, again, mention the walking meditation, which goes with the sitting meditation. He knows a hall over there, a hall in the back, and a hall over there. You may have seen some people doing some walking meditation. You see, we have red carpets there for you, which is one of the reasons why I got the color red, to try and encourage you. This is red carpet treatment. So you walk, that's actually yoga mats. And the floor is concrete. I made sure the floor was like grey and boring and cold and hard to encourage people to walk on the yoga mats. You know what happens otherwise? There's always someone in one room, instead of having like eight people able to do walking meditation, decides they want to walk diagonal wise. Which means that no one else can walk there at all. So make sure we do it sort of little yoga mats. So they can actually, many people can walk in one room. So you start walking. At the very beginning, again, your gaze about sort of one body length ahead of you. Not to the left, not to the right. You can put your hands wherever you want to. But just keep them there, make them comfortable, and you start walking. Simple as that. Then after a while, when you get to the end, you turn around and come back again. I always say one of the great advantages of walking meditation is you don't get anywhere. you end up where you started. Welcome to life. You start this life with no teeth, you end with no teeth. You start it wearing nappies. If you live long enough and become incontinent, you end up with nappies. You just go round and round. But anyway, so this idea of achieving something, getting somewhere, that's one thing which it doesn't encourage at all. So you're just walking. And instead of getting somewhere, you're being here. In this moment. What's going on? And after a while, you start to focus on the movement of your legs. To actually lift one foot, to balance the body on the other leg, and actually move forward, and then put that foot down, is incredibly complicated. It's why people who've ever had a stroke, who have to learn how to walk again, describe just how difficult it is. There's so many movements of muscles, but we've just taken it for granted. But now, you're being aware of how the foot moves. Which part of the foot leaves the ground first? Which part leaves last? When you start walking, does your foot go straight up? And then vertical across and then down. Of course, it has its trajectory. Mine goes up and it goes back a little bit. And then it goes on an arc forward. And then when your foot meets the ground, which part meets the ground first? Which last? What does it feel like when you transfer your weight from the foot which was immobile to the foot which has just reached a step forward? To be able to free that other foot to do its step. And there are so many amazing movements. Just one step. So after a while, when you start to focus on that, it becomes fascinating. And I used to love those walking meditations when I was a monk in Bangkok. So much so, it was, well, the hall was maybe shorter than this hall here, but it used to take me half an hour to get from here to there, turn around and come back again. I wasn't trying to be slow, it just was too much going on, you couldn't rush it. And I always remember that experience, which I say about walking meditation, you get so still, so inside. You did have quite a degree of stillness, that I was enjoying my walking, and got all these amazing feelings going on in the body. And then I didn't realize just how quiet I had become, because I really couldn't hear much. But I did hear somebody calling me from a distance. Like, you know, the feeling they're talking, calling you like a million miles away. Brahma Wang So. Brahma Wang So. Which was the full name. I thought, wow, that's weird. Maybe I got that divine ear, I can hear sounds a long way away. But then I realized it was a monk shouting in my ear hole about this far away. I'd forgot I had an appointment, like a dana to go to. That's, you know, the offering of food. And I was so into my meditation that I'd forgot all about it, and the abbot had sent a junior monk to come and get me. And he was trying to get me, shouting in my ear, Rama Wang So. But I was, Rama Wang So. It was weird. It's true. And then I realized, you know, I had to be respectful, and I'd forgotten this was a monk senior to me. And so, as fast as I could, and it wasn't fast at all, because when you're really chilled out, you can't hardly move, because as I started moving my head, there were so many muscles have to move just to turn your head a little bit. And it was fascinating watching it all work. And I just tried my fastest, but I just couldn't do it. I took about a couple of minutes until I could face him. fortunately, because he was a monk, he knows what meditation is like, and so he realized I wasn't crazy, I just got very chilled out and very still. But you can do that in walking meditation. So much going on, it's enjoyable, it's fascinating. You don't force it. You have to force me to come out. And that is how we do our walking meditation, also our breath meditation. There's so much going on. Once you've got the mindfulness coming up, you just watch the breath coming in. Amazing. And it pauses. As the lungs have got enough oxygen, it pauses. And then you start to exhale. And just to make it interesting for you, because people like having tests. So I'm now going to give you a test. Which is the longest, your in-breath or your out-breath? Don't ask me now, because that's only just one breath. Just throughout the whole day, see if you can find out which is going to be the longest, the in-breath or the out-breath. And is it smooth? The intensity of the intake of breath, does it suddenly start taking it in and then stops? Or does it build up as you pick up more and more oxygen? And then does it just fade away and the peak is in the middle? Or does it breathe in and then quite quickly just stop? And the space between the breaths, the space between your in-breath and out-breath, or between the out-breath and the in-breath, which is longer? Now, I say these little tests not because I want the answer, because it gives you some interesting stuff to do with your breathing. And after a while, you really get in just to watching your breath. So you can sit here just watching your breath. This is interesting and it's delightful to see a world in a grain of sand, to see piti sukha in one in-breath. Joy and happiness. Wow. Because once you start to get the joy and happiness with the breath, what I used to call the beautiful breath, but I think these days I prefer calling it delightful breath. It's just delightful just to see and watch this tiny little breath, like a wildflower which has been neglected inside of your body. And now you're paying attention. And it opens up to you. It smiles back at you. And this little breath, breathing in, breathing out. You're not focusing on anything. You are not focusing. You are not doing it. The breath just draws you in. It's delightful. And that delightful breath, once you can focus on it, sorry, so you don't focus on it, once it appears that you're focusing on it, because it's automatic, that you are just noticing this breath going in and going out. So you don't even notice it going in and going out. It's just happening. Delightful. Enjoyable. And I call that the pivot point, the tipping point of meditation. Once you get to that degree of mindfulness, it's not concentration. It's not focusing, because that's what you do. This is just what happens. Because you've done very little, because you've rested, because the attention has got into the mind, into the knower, not to the doer. Food starts to taste more delicious. The grass looks just more green. The sunset, the sunrise, or even just the clouds going across the sky, you appreciate them much more. The birds in the morning. It's gorgeous. And your breath, gorgeous. Now you can do breath meditation. It's natural, it's easy, and it's so delightful. And the delightful breath meditation doesn't stop there. It really picks up. And that's when you start blissing out. Breathing in, breathing out. And what do you mean by blissing out doing the breath meditation? This happens naturally. Don't think you can't do it. despite you. In fact, when you get out of the way, it happens. You can stop it happening, yeah, but you can't make it happen. So after a while, it happens. You're blissfully watching the breath going in and going out. Delightful. For hours. Happy little meditator. And it gets so happy, so delightful, you're so content. There's always a curse. Somebody, they're meditating here and it's working. Delightful. This is all so nice. And you kind of know it's 11 o'clock, lunchtime. And you're on a dilemma. Should I break my meditation and have lunch, knowing that there's no dinner in the evening? Or should I carry on meditating, knowing I'll miss lunch because the meditation is so delightful? And you carry on meditating. There's always people do that. That's how delightful it is. You know you don't want to eat because the meditation is much more delightful. You sit here just enjoying, oh, this is nice. And if anyone says, ah, it's indulgence, indulgence, you're getting attached to the pleasures of meditation. Attachment is bad. Attachment isn't always bad. If you're on the back of a motorbike going through busy traffic, please be attached. Some of these have got bad meanings, attachment, bad, without even thinking about it. Some things are great to be attached to. Be attached to your compassion, to your precepts, to your goodness, to your kindness. Be attached to the joys of the mind through meditation. They're delightful. They're almost the heart of this practice. They bring the smile onto the face of a Buddha. And they create so many great meditators and enlightened beings. The smile. So this is where we literally bring the joy into our meditation. So much so, if you can see a lump of concrete for a quarter of an hour, I think it's so beautiful. Imagine what you can do with your breath. Breathing in, breathing out. Gorgeous. For much longer than a quarter of an hour. That's how we meditate. And sometimes, just before I finish off, sometimes people say, oh no, I'm just a beginner. Talk about all this big high stuff, that's for these professional meditators, and not me. Those people who say, not me, they're the ones who get it. Sometimes, okay, here comes this bit of a story quickly. Sometimes that I look at the people when they come in here, some I've known you for a long time, some of you just are just obviously high flyers, you know, very, very obviously successful people in your own right. And then there are some like hopeless cases. People have been sent here by their husband, you know, to get rid of them for a week, hoping that something might happen to them. All sorts here. And in all the years I've been meditating, I just cannot predict who gets the deep, beautiful meditations. I just can't predict it. I don't know. Because you can't tell. You can't stereotype. I did stereotype a person a couple of years ago, and that was a fellow who came here full of tattoos. He's an Australian guy. Tattoos, scruffy looking, singlet, you know, Australian national dress, shorts and a couple of leather thongs. Tattoos all over him, really big. Now, you may know that just up the road here, about 6 kilometers, is a prison, kind of prison farm. And straight away, seeing all those tats all over his body and this rough character, I stereotyped him. Stupid old monk. And I said, "Oh, sir, I think you got the wrong place. The prison is up the road." I make a fool of myself very often. But one thing, you make a mistake like that, you make a fool of yourself, please share it with everybody, because it makes everyone laugh. If you're always wise, you wouldn't have any stories to tell. So anyway, he said, "No, look, I'm on the list." And the list was there, and he said, "There's my name there." I said, "Oh, really? Oh, yeah, okay, fair enough." Never seen you before. So, and he was the one, after a couple of days, you know, on the interviews, he sat down in front of me. And he said, "Oh, I had these experiences." And he started telling me them. And I was just amazed. He was describing some of the deepest of jhanas. Where did you get that from? He was the most unlikely of probably all the meditators who've sat in here. The one, you know, I would have least expected. The outsider in the race. And he was the one who won it. Amazing. So from that day on, each one of you can do that. I don't think, "Oh, that's so unfair. I've been meditating here for such a long time. I come here everywhere and I just really try hard. I give donations, I help sweep, and I just, unfair. This guy just rocks in with..." Your mistake was you didn't have enough tattoos. No, it's nothing to do with tattoos, obviously. But it's just that, you know, he just got this subtle thing of learning how to let go, do nothing, be peaceful. And enjoy this moment. Don't be afraid of the joy which has nothing to do with the defilements. Experience the joy. And little by little, you do see a world in a grain of sand. You see bliss in the breath. Incredible wonder in just being here. And that bliss just keeps on growing, and that becomes the jhanas. Later on, you realize why this was the case. That's where the insight happens. But that's another talk. Another day. Sadhu. Sadhu. Sadhu.